Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me as tonight's co-host, courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger. By now well known as a frequent guest on Your Legal Rights, Josh practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of areas. We've been consumed with such matters as a global pandemic, a very divisive election season that culminated with threats to our democracy. As the nation is guided, hopefully with some success, towards healing, Your Legal Rights turns its attention to some of the business at home. As tonight, we look at estate planning. And it seems, Josh, we could not hear you. Want to repeat that?
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now. You are live.
Sorry about that, everyone. It's ironic that as we watch the control of our government handed off from one generation of leadership to another, we are tonight discussing preparation for the handoff of much of what defines us as individuals, our wealth, our property, our things and possessions from one generation to the next.
What happens if I die without a will? What does it matter if my property transfers through or avoids probate? I just learned that a friend named me as executor of his estate. What have I gotten myself into? Must I agree? As always, we're anxious to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, at 415-841-4134 if you're in the Bay Area. Or if you're outside the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, our attorney guests cannot give you specific legal advice. We don't have all of the salient facts of your situation, but we're happy to share the legal principles that will help guide you in your decision-making. And you can contact us with any question of estate planning or avoiding taxation. You're not limited to the exact point that we may be in our conversation. Tonight, we plan for those people and those things that live on beyond us. And as we plan for our estates, our property and possessions, and transferring them to our loved ones to guide us.
With over 20 years of legal experience, attorney Sherry Michaelis provides expert estate planning services to clients. She serves clients in the areas of probate, estate planning, special needs trusts, trust administration, business succession planning, and real estate property transfers.
A former member of the State Bar of California Board of Trustees, Janet Brewer has practiced California estate, gift planning, and probate law exclusively for more than 20 years. She is certified by the California State Bar Board of Legal Specialization as an estate planning and probate specialist. She also holds a master's degree in taxation with a concentration in estate and gift tax law. Her practice includes preparing wills and revocable living trusts, administering estates and trusts, probating estates, forming family limited partnerships and limited liability companies, and establishing a wide variety of tax-sensitive trusts, including children's trust, charitable trust, and irrevocable life insurance trusts.
Certified by the California State Bar Board of Legal Specialization as an estate planning and probate specialist, with a master's degree in taxation, Alexandra Godzo is able to use trusts and other legal strategies to reduce estate tax obligations and strengthen the control you have over asset distribution after you've passed. Whether you seek to transfer business ownership to your children or protect your grandchildren's inheritance, she helps you identify the best approach for realizing these goals, drawing on her substantial understanding of state and federal tax laws to assess the tax benefits and drawbacks associated with various types of trusts. Alexandra is also a licensed real estate broker.
So, to everybody, one and all, Janet, Alexandra, Sherry, and Josh, welcome one and all to Your Legal Rights. You know, before we go further, I'd like to begin with a real simple question and throw it open to everybody. just in broad terms, what is estate planning?
Well, I'll jump in, Jeff. Estate planning is, as you said in the introduction, it's planning for what happens to your stuff after you die or become incapacitated. That's the simplest explanation. Who gets it? What do they get? When do they get it? What kind of strings are attached to it? That is what estate planning is.
If I can add in one thing too, I completely agree with Janet. It's kind of like, you know, who's going to get your house? Who's going to live there? Who's going to take care of your kids? You know, what's going to happen if you're in the hospital? Who's going to pay your mortgage? All those kinds of things.
Does it also bring in other things such as I'm in a professional practice. If something happens to me, who's going to close it out and take care of the clients that are there and make sure that everything is neatly bundled and closed?
Yes, absolutely. I think every practice
is that area
has special requirements, but definitely business succession planning as well. License planning is of essence, and it's part of the set of documents that we create. Usually it's 10 to 12 basic documents that come with a comprehensive estate plan.
Let me turn it over to Dan from Burlingame. Dan, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thanks, Jeff. A close friend of mine passed recently, and I was told his will is sealed, and I'm wondering if this is common.
The answer is no. I've never heard of a sealed will.
Interesting.
Yeah, me neither.
Well, that answers the question. Thank you.
Well, let me do a little follow-up while you're on the line, Dan. Under what circumstances would somebody have their will sealed?
Well, basically, I've heard of times when people had secret wills or secret trusts where they didn't want their spouse to know what was in it, so they had a private or a secret will or a trust that was sealed.
While we're talking about wills, one of the things that people commonly ask is, what happens if you die without a will? In essence, you're trying to explain to your family member you need to set up your estate planning. One of the things is the will. But how do you explain to them what happens to all their property, all their stuff, if they don't have one?
Well, one thing, Josh, is that a lot of people think a will and don't realize a lot of times that they're really talking about a trust. So if someone dies without a will or a trust, basically everything they have goes according to the laws of California intestate succession, which means it may be completely not at all what someone wants. So it could be that if they don't have parents, they don't have a wife or a husband or a spouse or kids, that everything goes to some distant cousin. So basically, you know, not having a will or a trust, you don't know who's going to get your property. It just depends on who's alive at that time in your family.
Isn't the laws of intestate succession just common sense, what the overwhelming majority of people would want, but it might not work in a given case? Maybe it first goes to the kids. Well, obviously the non-community portion that doesn't go to a spouse might go first to the kids, but if there's no kids, it looks to the parents and then down to the kids of the parents and down and then up and then down and then up. Isn't that kind of the way that it goes?
That's sort of true, Jeff. And, you know, yeah, for some people that might not be a bad plan, but some of the, you know, for example, let's assume the person is married. If they've got one kid, the spouse gets half of it, and the surviving kid, even if the kid's only 10 years old, gets the other half. And if the 10, you know, the maybe if we're talking a couple of $100,000, that's not such a bad thing. The property gets managed until the kid turns 18, and then they'll go, you know, but let's face it, in this area, there's lots of estates that have a lot of money. How would you feel about an 18-year-old, you know, getting $5 million to do with as he pleases with no supervision? So the plan itself may be not bad, but the results may not be what you expected them to be.
I work with a lot of young people, and I know some 18-year-olds that you would think might have been 40 if you spoke with the person. But I've also spoken with some that are very undeveloped in that you would think you were talking at a 10-year-old. It's a very individual thing, but particularly when there's a lot of assets, you would want to protect that person from themselves, from fulfilling their vices, if nothing else.
Right. And I know this is sort of Sherry's area of expertise, but, you know, the other problem with no will or no trust is if you've got a beneficiary that has special needs or is on SSI or SSDI, getting a large amount of money with no plan in place could be a disaster for them as well.
Sherry, you mentioned the trust, differentiating that from a will. Perhaps you could explain for people, what is the difference between them and when would you use one versus the other?
Sure. So basically, if someone has over $50,000 worth of real estate and or $150,000 worth of other assets, then they really should have a trust set up, because otherwise, if they have those assets and they're not in a type of vehicle that goes directly to someone, they go through the probate system. And the probate system is just horrible here in California. It basically takes, usually now it's taken almost 2 years for probate, and it's very, very expensive. It's not unusual to have probate fees over $50,000. So by having a trust, you can completely avoid that by having the assets in the trust, because you pick someone who's going to carry out your wishes instead of having the court do it for you.
Let's start with the idea of a simple will, though. How do I take care of making up a will? How do I execute or sign a will?
Well, I would recommend to see a lawyer to get the appropriate legal advice, because if you decide to write a holographic will, which anyone can do with their own handwriting, date, and sign it, the issues are that the person could accidentally put in conflicting language, such as, I leave something to my wife, I leave something to my children, to my sister, but then there could be provisions for the same item going to the same person, or it's not clear whether it's an equal shares or what percentages somebody gets. So it's in California in particular, it's advisable to get an attorney and if at all possible, to really try to use the vehicle of a trust where we can avoid probate proceedings, again, because of the expense and the length of time, because all assets are basically locked up. All the accounts are no longer accessible to anybody when someone passes. So it's an onerous process, and it takes 2 years to administer. That those are the timelines that we're looking at.
The other thing, I remember it was not that many years ago when the advice people were given is to save money and write a holographic will. And what, for those people that are listening, a holographic will is one that you write yourself. You may see it in a book or something that you can borrow language from. But even if you get all the distributions aired out completely to where there's no mystery to it and everybody knows your intentions, people don't realize a holographic will has to be handwritten from beginning to end and then signed. And today, so many people don't write anything down anymore. They draw it up on a computer and print it. And if you print something like that and sign it, is it still the case where that doesn't work? If you didn't handwrite it, it's basically as if it never existed?
That's a tough one, Jeff. For the most part, the answer is yes. I've actually got a situation similar to that. Someone typed up a will, and the only thing he did is he signed it himself, no witnesses, so it doesn't meet the requirements of California law for being admitted to probate. The people that he named as getting his property and his will are way different than the people who would get the property without the will. It is sometimes possible to get a will that doesn't comply with the letter of the law into probate, but you're probably looking at a lot of expense and heartache trying to get it done.
And isn't it true, though, that you're going to have some things where, for example, if you have bank accounts, if you have investments, it's going to, you have a beneficiary that you sign off. So certain things, how does that fit in, that aren't in the will, that aren't in the trust, they just transfer automatically? Do you take
care
of that?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Josh. So there are assets that are called like payable on death, and those assets generally supersede what's written in a trust or a will. So even if you write in your will, oh, this account goes to so-and-so, but in that actual account, you write a beneficiary to be your sister. Well, then it's generally going to your sister because the actual payable on death account generally supersedes what's written in the trust or the will.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight we have an all-star cast, and we're taking a look at planning your estate with Alexandra Gadzo, Janet Brewer, and Sherry Michaelis. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, we'll pay the freight. It's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to planning your estate or even transferring your business or practice that it might continue after you do not. You're not limited to the exact point that we may be in our conversation. Again, toll free, 866-798-8255. So when do people really, when should they be putting this stuff together? I mean, should they be doing it where they live now? How do they know where they'll be in years down the road when they become ill or when they pass?
I mean, obviously, if it's a, you know, people do move around a lot more these days than they did 20 or 30 years ago. The law says that if the document is valid in the state where it's made, it's going to be valid in whatever state the person lives in at the time of their death. But, you know, what I put together 20 years ago could be totally inappropriate today. So the best thing to do is, you know, if they move from one state to another, see a lawyer and make sure that what they've got is still up to date and does what they want it to do.
So what happens if you draft up these documents? Do you tell somebody that you have to tell people I had them drafted? They're at this lawyer's office, because if you up and die, people may not know that. So where are these documents kept, and what is the process then for what happens when you die?
Yeah, most people, like, they'll keep the documents like in one of two places. Like, you know, like for us, we usually give clients a hard copy, a bound copy, and also a soft copy. So we do recommend that they at least send a portion of it, not necessarily all the documents, but at least the certificate to their trustee, and let their whole family know where they keep it, and let their family know that they have a trust. And I always say, of course, you can tell them the attorney who prepared it as well, so they can get in touch with the attorney. But really important to make sure that the family members know that the person has a trust in a will and where they're located.
Can somebody tell us, you hear so much about what needs to be done for the will. You need a certain number of witnesses and so forth. I've been at places where people have had this dispute constantly. Can somebody tell us, what do you really need to do so that the will is valid?
Sure, I can go into that. This is Alexandra. What we do in California is we quote unquote publish a will. And what that means is the will requires the signature of the testator and then also two independent witnesses. So for instance, if you're leaving your assets to your spouse or to your children, those children are interested parties, or your spouse is an interested party. So you really need an independent adult, someone who's over the age of 18 and who is a domiciliary in the United States. So in other words, can't be a visitor from out of the country, but someone who resides, they don't have to reside in the state of California, but they have to be a U.S. resident to witness your will. And if for some reason your will disappears or there is a contest and that witness can be brought into court to testify as far as what the contents of the wills are possibly and also capacity and whether the testator actually signed that will, that they witness the signature. And so then you technically have three people involved in the witnessing of the will. And that's called publishing the will in the state of California.
Do the witnesses typically get copies of it?
No, they don't. It remains typically all the planning documents remain private. They're not shared with anyone. They're not registered anywhere. So that's why it's important if you're going to designate someone as your executor or as your successor trustee that you inform the people that you have designated so that they're not blindsided, not knowing that they're going to have this very important role to administer your estate. And I typically tell my clients to keep their estate planning documents somewhere where they're accessible, possibly on a bookshelf at home or not in a safe deposit box, because if your successor trustee or executor doesn't have access to your safe deposit box, nobody's going to be able to get your documents.
You know, before we move on, I did want to ask about that. I received a text from a caller just moments ago that was asking me about that very issue. In this case, the testator is alive, but maybe not quite the level of capacity that she once had and doesn't know where these documents are. And can't recreate what she doesn't remember exactly what's in them, but is pretty much aware. She knows what she has. Is there any place you could recommend where she might go and find them?
You know, Jeff, if they don't have the documents, I mean, they're, you know, the best they can do is recreate them. And if the person doesn't have capacity, that's a real problem. At that point, you know, maybe you have to go in and get a petition for substituted judgment, and that can get expensive. That can get time consuming.
You mentioned capacity. So what you're saying, you can only do your trust and estates if you have capacity. Can you tell us what is capacity and how do you determine if the person in front of you has capacity?
The joys of Zoom, we have a brief pause in between people, which sometimes happens. I know a few hundred years ago, it was a really easy question whether somebody understands and knows the nature and extent of their bounty. But I would imagine that in today's world, that's changed a little bit.
That's still the basic question. But, you know, the problem is that trying to prove it. I mean, there are sort of some, you know, typical tests that you use to figure out if a person has capacity. It's as you know, as you said, you know, the nature, who are the typical objects of your bounty? Do you realize that you're married and you've got a wife or a husband? Do you realize that you have kids? You know, what's your orientation? What, you know, to reality? And there are some basic tests that you can administer to people to find that out. But, you know, it can be a big issue trying to figure out, does someone have enough capacity to do a will or not? Or are they being unduly influenced by someone? You know, is the person that brought them in really acting in their best interests, or are they acting in that person's own best interests?
We started off at times talking about trusts and estates, and you hear the term revocable trust thrown around a lot. What is a revocable trust, and how do you differentiate that from a non-revocable trust?
Sure. This is Sherry. So basically, revocable trust is a trust that can be changed anytime. And a lot of times, most of the trusts that people think about when you hear about living trust or, you know, revocable living trust, they're all the same trust. It's basically a trust that can be changed. as long as the person's alive and has capacity to change it. An irrevocable trust is generally a trust that usually cannot be changed without going to court or doing a number of, you know, legal matters, you know, writing up a lot of legal requirements and usually filing that with the court and getting everyone to approve it. So basically, irrevocable trust generally can't be changed unless through a court order or something like that. And revocable trust can be changed anytime by the people who have created it.
When you talk about a revocable trust, if two people jointly put their properties into a trust, does that usually require both of them to participate and get the property out?
Generally, it's just the person who put the property in. So it's generally like, hey, if you put the property in, you can take it out. If the other person put a property in, they can take it out. It's usually whoever's property it is can take it out.
But to your point, Jeff, I mean, if it's community property, for example, usually it does require both people, both the husband and the wife, or I should probably say both spouses, to consent to put it in or take it out.
So if it's separate property and two married people put their properties into a trust, would they generally change the character of the property before putting it in the trust so that it now requires both of them? Or would one be able to dupe the other by taking their property out?
No. You can keep it the same. You can keep the same character of the property. Just because you put it in the trust does not change the character unless you actually change it to community property.
Given that we all change our minds on estate planning over time, what would be the reason for signing a non-revocable trust?
Well, there might be some tax reasons to do it. For example, if you're trying to get assets out of your estate, but the people that you're giving them to are young, under the age of 18, for example, and you don't want them to have immediate control over the property, that might be a reason for doing it. There are a lot of reasons for doing an irrevocable trust, but commonly it's you're trying to do a gift today and you want the gift to go to someone who, for whatever reason, cannot or should not manage that money themselves.
Alexandra, it looked like you had something to add. Please.
Yes, I wanted to add also, oftentimes you can place a life insurance policy into an irrevocable trust, and the proceeds of that life insurance policy then is distributed not only income tax-free to the beneficiaries, but also estate tax-free to the beneficiaries. So it's a beautiful vehicle to pass on a tremendous amount of assets at a high valuation, basically, to the next generation or to a significant other or for charitable costs. So,
you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
This is KALW San Francisco at 91.7 FM. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you like, and if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. This is Your Legal Rights, and at 7 o'clock we'll have a special edition of Your Call with Rose Aguilar.
And as you've just heard, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden. Joining me tonight's co-host, Josh Berger. You've heard him many times. He's a great contributor to this program, and we appreciate that. But tonight we're talking estate planning, and we have an all-star cast. We're taking a look at planning your estate with Alexandra Gadzo, Janet Brewer, and Sherry Michaelis. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, you can call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. Really, that's any question relating to planning for your estate or transferring your business or practice that I can continue after. You're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation. You could call us with any related question, as did Warren from Oakland. Warren, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
I had a question kind of coming from the other way. What if I'm the executive of a will and it turns out there's like debt and there's really no estate? I guess there's a fear. Will banks or somebody come after me? How much rights do they have to try and collect debt when there's really, there's just debts. There's just not much left. I mean, there's no house, there's no real estate, there's, clothes, I don't know, dishes, but that's kind of my question coming from the other end. What if there is nothing? Do I still need to file probate or go through the law?
Generally, if there's no assets at all and there's absolutely nothing in the estate,
yeah,
as long as no one takes anything from the estate, then, it's not like you're liable because you're the trustee or because you're the executor. It doesn't mean you're liable for the debts. So as long as you didn't take anything, that's really the key, as long as you didn't take anything from the estate.
No, there's not. There's sentimental things. But there's really nothing. I'm just guessing that. Yeah. I guess that's the fear, that somebody would come after me or somebody to try and get something for the debt. But I guess if there's nothing there, then there's nothing there.
Yeah, you don't assume personal liability for the estate. If you're the executor, it's not like you're on the line for paying any debts. Again, as Sherry said, the only way that you would have to pay any debts is if you took money from the estate or if you took assets from the estate. Then a creditor might be able to sue you for the value of the assets.
Dishes. I'm kind of laughing because I'm sure a bank doesn't want dishes or photographs or old clothes or things like that.
Frankly, it sounds to me like you wouldn't even go through probate on that.
Okay.
But, if there's...
I'm just thinking of the situation. I'm sure there's people in massive debt now with COVID and stuff. Like, it's kind of the other side of the question. Thank you much. Yeah, that sounds... Yeah. I think that's good. Thank you.
Thank you, Warren. I hope we answered your questions. And let me turn to Mark from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, hi. Thank you. My parents recently passed away, both of them, and I have some tax issues myself, and my brother decided he's going to solve the tax issues, and so he wanted power of attorney, which I gave him. And I guess my questions are these. If he has my power of attorney, is there a way for me to find out what actions the agent has taken if I'm the principal with the power of attorney? And also, is there a way for me to find out what my parents' wills and or trusts had contained?
Okay, I think what you're asking is, you've given power of attorney to somebody, and you want to know what they've executed since the time you gave them that power of attorney.
That's right.
What would you recommend in this regard? Anybody want to jump in? Sherry, you look like you have something on the tip of your tongue.
So he mentioned something about his parents passing. So is it he that gave the power of attorney for himself to someone else, or is it his parents that had given the power of attorney to someone?
No, it was myself. I gave him my power of attorney so he could deal with my tax situation.
Got it. Well, you should, just because, the power of attorney, assuming you're of sound mind, you can get back You know, it doesn't mean that you've given it away. So you can go take it back and look at all your medical, your bank records and all of your assets and just make see what's been taken out, if anything. And you can revoke a power of attorney as long as you're of sound mind to do so. So you can take him off if you'd like. You can check all your records and see what was taken out to make sure that he didn't do anything that you wouldn't have wanted him to do.
And what also, I mean, he's also what we call a fiduciary. I mean, he has obligations to you. I think there is there's a misunderstanding that when someone gives a power of attorney, they're surrendering rights, and they're not. They're just sharing the rights. So just because he has the power of attorney doesn't mean that you've given up the right to act. You've just kind of made him a partner with you.
I see. And as pertains to my parents' wills and or trusts, are there ways to find out what exactly those contained? If he isn't offering to let me know what their wills and or trusts contained, is there another way for me to find out?
Yeah, he's required to let you know. I mean, how long ago was it that your parents passed?
A few months ago.
A few months ago. So yeah, I mean, generally the trustee or executor needs to give notice. So you should have been given notice and a copy of the will and the trust, at least if you requested it. You should have been given a notification. Does he have an attorney helping him?
Probably.
But you don't know who that is, right?
No, I don't know.
You know, if he fails to give you notice, you can always go to court and file a petition demanding notice. You've got that right as well.
Okay, I think that's what I was asking. Thank you very much.
All righty, thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. And let me turn it to Julia from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, good evening. We have a revocable trust made up about 10 years ago, and now there's people listed on it that no longer are alive. I would assume I should go back to that lawyer and then bring it up to current. My other question is, I'm pretty sure about this, but there is a will that is also within the trust. Is that correct?
Yes, this is Alexandra. Yes, you should definitely go back to your previous attorney and amend and restate your trust. And typically as part of the estate planning process, when you execute your trust, we include a pour over will. And what that means is that your will is quite short and it says, everything I own, I want it to be distributed pursuant to the terms of my trust. So that when your will is lodged with the county where you reside to let the world know that you have passed away, your trust remains private and your trust terms remain private. Since it's been about 10 years, I would definitely recommend you revisit your trust and you amend and restate your trust. And part of that will also be your will and your power of attorney, your financial power of attorney, and most likely your medical directives as well.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. And let me turn it to John from Berkeley. Welcome to your legal rights.
Thank you very much. I was wondering if your guest might be able to speak in general terms to what people might want to keep in mind if there's a couple who've been married 60 years and one of them passes. What are the tax implications, like, for example, for the value of a home or and other stuff that one might want to keep in mind related to trust and other just general good estate planning when that event happens?
Can you repeat that again? We got most of it. And I got that you want to know about the tax implications of the surviving spouse, but I didn't quite catch what you were saying after that.
Oh, I'm sorry. So been married 60 years, one passes away, and what implications are there with respect to the home they own? You know, the basis might change. So property tax implications as well as income tax implications regarding you know, and smart things one might want to do for estate planning and trust and inheritance for offspring, that kind of stuff when one longtime spouse passes.
Let me ask you a couple questions on that. Is this planning ahead of time, or are you talking about something that's already occurred?
It's already occurred.
Do you know how the two held the property, whether they held it as joint tenants or as community property, or community, exactly what?
Community property, yes.
Okay, that, I think, gives my guests more directions. I see lips moving like they're ready to speak. Alexandra, you want to jump in?
Yeah, sure. So this is Alexandra. There are a lot of moving parts. I mean, so it depends. It sounds like the decedent owned a house, community property with the surviving spouse. So there is a step up in basis, and the house should be appraised. But there's I call it a mini trust administration that should occur if it's in the name of a trust. So it depends really how title is held to the real estate. How title is held to the assets. If it's in the name of a trust, then we would administer the trust terms and get appraisals on the house done, get appraisals of all the stocks, and there's a step up in basis at the first death. But it sounds like there are a lot more, it sounds like there are a lot of assets in this estate. So each different assets get different treatment. Homes and stocks get different treatment from a retirement account. So the surviving spouse should definitely get legal and tax advice to administer it properly.
The concept of step up I'm familiar with as pertains to property. Does that happen to, is that applicable to other asset classes?
It is. They're held together if they're held jointly together and held, you know, basically like community property. Yes. But also, you know, just to add to what Alexandra said, and this is Sherry, basically you want to also just have that trust, assuming the assets were in a trust, to have that trust reviewed, because some of the trusts require that one half of the assets or one spouse's assets become unchangeable and have to be placed in an irrevocable trust. And that's really important to make sure that that gets done, because if that trust doesn't get funded, there could be a lot of issues and income tax and estate tax and all kinds of other issues. And also, depending what the value of the assets were, there may be some tax returns that need to be filed, like a special estate tax return, depending upon what the value of the assets are. So basically, you want to make sure to talk to an attorney and a CPA, have them review if there is a trust and what the assets are, value them all, and basically allow them to give you guidance on what the next steps would be to make sure to administer the estate properly.
Okay, well, that sounds like good advice to me.
And John, if you did get advice recently, I would advise you to update that advice. Some of those things that you would have received advice on may have changed in the last couple months, or maybe about to change, given the passage of Proposition 19. We covered that in some detail last week, where we did a whole show devoted to Proposition 19. I have the feeling we scratched the surface. And what I walked away with is sometimes things that you might do to save on property taxes might be contrary to your interests in income taxes, or vice versa. So there's a lot of moving parts, and you really want to have somebody give you advice.
I heard that show. It was a wonderful show. It was very useful. I gathered that same thing. I love your show. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us and for your kind words. Thank you, John. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. This is Jeff Hayden, and I'm joined tonight by co-host Josh Borger. Our time is running short, but you still do have a couple minutes if you want to give us a quick call. We're talking about estate planning with an all-star cast of Janet Brewer, Alexandra Gadzo, Sherry Michaelis. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. You can call us toll-free at 866-798-825. You don't have to jump right into our conversation with all fours. You can ask us any related question to tonight's topic. And we even pay the freight at 866-798-8255. You know, I did want to ask about some related stuff. Like, we've talked about trusts and wills and the like. Sometimes you're holding something and trust, you've left it to somebody else. What kind of changes can they make after I'm gone?
None. This is Alexandra. None. You can't change. Once the person has died, the trust documents and the will becomes irrevocable, non-changeable.
Alexandra, I'd change that just a little bit, because if it's an AB plan, for example, maybe half of, if it's a joint trust and there's a surviving spouse, the survivor can change the survivor's portion, but they can't change the portion of the person that passed away.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Janet. Right.
So can you explain to our audience, what is the trustee and how much discretion does the trustee have to act in implementing the trust?
Yeah, so I can take that one. I'm Sherry. The trustee is basically what a lot of people think of as the executor. So a lot of people think, ooh, a will has an executor. Well, the trustee of the trust is just like the executor of the will. They're in charge. So they're the ones who have to basically value everything, pay all taxes, distribute everything at the end of the day, make sure everything is done properly. You know, if there's young children, they would often be the ones in charge of setting up trusts for the young children. If one of the trusts becomes irrevocable, they've got to take care of all that. Basically, they're the ones in charge. They're like the director of everything. And they basically have a requirement not to self-deal. They're not allowed to steal the money and take it themselves, but they're basically in charge of making sure that those assets go as the person who set up the trust wanted them to go, right, directly to the beneficiaries. So that's their job.
I just received another request from a listener. This is something that we got really close to answering before, but the listener is asking, how do they find an unrecorded trust document? Any suggestions?
You know, I'm sure all three of us have experienced this many times. We'll get an email blast from our local bar association saying, if anybody has prepared a trust or a will for John Smith, please get in touch with so-and-so. But I mean, it's on the person that prepared the documents to keep track of where they are, just like you would with any other important paper. If they don't keep it, there's no, as somebody else said earlier, there's no central place that you can go and look for a copy of the trust. It's just one of those things that people have to do for themselves.
And oftentimes the attorneys will at some point turn it over to the clients and say, here's all your copies. Isn't that the unfortunate case?
I frankly never keep my clients' originals. The days when I could expect to be the attorney for three generations of clients and they'd all stay in Palo Alto are long gone. I just give people their originals. I keep a set of copies, but it's their originals and they need to keep track of them.
Yeah, we do the same thing, Janet. We never keep originals of anything. We're now like quote unquote paperless. Everything gets scanned in. So the clients are the only ones that have the originals, but you know, they do get usually a soft copy as well. So they should really be letting everyone know that they have a trust, where it's located, possibly who their attorney is, you know, just in case of an emergency, really is what they should be doing.
And while we have a brief time left, let me turn it to George in San Francisco. George, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
It's kind of late in the show for this question, but the question is, given that you've put your trust in an exceedingly well-labeled, conspicuous location and people could find it, the next thing is, when you call, I think this came up for a moment, when you call around or what happens, A, B, C, when you approach the attorneys or other advocates' stash of records and say, yes, I've got one here for you. What are the steps that continue from that? And how do you continue to get the information that your heretofore didn't even know it existed? Okay?
Did you follow that? I think from the expression on your face, Janet, you needed a little clarification on that. George, can you help clarify your question a little bit? We didn't quite all track it.
Somebody passes away and you find out about it, and you're named or maybe you're not, but you want to follow up on the document that declares that this person has passed away, and here's my instructions. That's what you find yourself asking that question. What happens after that?
This is Alexander. I think what, and you may correct me if I'm misunderstanding your question, but it sounds that you might be named or you may want to know the contents of this particular trust or will. I do recommend if you're an interested party that you hire a lawyer for half an hour to an hour to help that lawyer guide you through the process to see whether you're named and whether you have a role as either a fiduciary and or beneficiary in the particular trust document.
Well, there's a list right there now. That means that you can go in expecting that someone who's welcomed at the attorney's table will give you those ingredients, feed them back to you. And then where do you go from there?
Well, if you're listed as trustee or a successor, if you're listed as successor trustee, then you can decide whether you want to take on that role. And I think we discussed before during the show whether, you know, you don't have to take on the role of executorship or trusteeship. It's something that you choose to take on, and then oftentimes clients will give alternate names for someone else to act, or sometimes they will even designate a bank or a fiduciary or a company, a fiduciary company that will take on the role, especially if it's a very large estate or difficult family dynamics. So there, you don't always have to designate your friends and family to be successor trustee.
There must be times. There must be times when someone is attempting to obfuscate the whereabouts or contents of these documents. Is that something you've seen, and what is the remedy for that?
Well, if somebody's trying to hide the documents, again, what if you have a valid interest in the documents, you're not just a nosy neighbor, but you believe that, you know, you're one of the children, or you have good reason to believe that you are actually named as a beneficiary in the document, you can file a petition with the court that provides basically notice, for example, to the nearest surviving relatives, saying, we believe that there's a will and we want it probated, or maybe you even actually... If the person isn't forthcoming with a will, perhaps you file a petition to be named as administrator of the estate, which is typically what's done when there isn't a will. That would force, if someone does have a valid will, that would force them basically to come forward and offer the will, proffer the will, and say, no, this person doesn't have the right to be in charge. I've got a will that says I'm in charge. And at least it gets it all out on the table.
Well, thanks very much for your good responses. Hopefully next time you come in, we can start on you a little earlier. Thanks.
George, thank you for joining us. I'd like to move a little further along. We've been talking about different types of instruments, wills, trusts. But let's talk about some of the things that are most important to us. Where do I really get to decide, or do I get to decide what happens to my kids when I pass? I mean, do I really have that say directly?
Hi, Jeff. Yeah, I'll respond to that one. And this is Sherry. Usually you do this in your will, typically, is where you state in general. That's where most people do that, where they would state who they would want to be in charge of their children. The only thing to keep in mind is that if you're divorced, or if you, you know, or not with your partner who you had your child with, you usually cannot take away parental rights from somebody else. So you can write in who you want, but it doesn't mean that if something happens to you, the child's other parent couldn't be in charge. But typically, the short answer is you usually do this in your will or a similar like document of appointment of guardian for the child.
Would the same be true of pets?
either the will or the trust is usually where, you know, you usually have someone who you would basically be in charge and willing to take your pet. Usually if you haven't chosen anyone, usually your trustee would be in charge of finding someone who can take the pet. But if you have someone in mind, that's a good thing to write into your documents.
What I've done is I left a little something for somebody to bear their expenses, to rehouse them and the like. There's enough there to make sure that they do what I want. Is that probably the best and only way to really go about it?
I think so.
Sorry.
No, go ahead, Janet. Yeah.
Yeah, in California, you can set up a pet trust that would be like Leona Helmsley did for her dog. You could leave $50 million to your favorite animal and have that be an enforceable trust. But, you know, for most people who just want to leave a few thousand dollars to make sure that the pet is well taken care of and that whoever accepts the pet isn't saddled with a bunch of veterinary bills, doesn't really go to the expense of setting up a formal trust. It's more of an informal thing, as you said, Jeff. I leave my dog and $5,000 to my friend with the hope that he'll take care of him for me.
And if I tried to leave $50 million to my friend, I might still be tied up long before anybody ever came to execute that document. They'd probably get rehoused, and I probably would too.
No, I'm going to forever now come to a crossroads in my life. And after that, Janet asked, what would Leona Helmsley do? Thank you for that. That's going to go with me forever. So there are people who want to do their own trusts and estates. You hear it. They want to save money on a lawyer. What do you say to these people? Is it something you can do yourself? You see these NOLO books. Can you do it? Or what I've always told people is you spend all this time and money caring for your children. You want to save a few thousand dollars and take a gamble that it's all going to work out fine when you die? That's probably not the right way to say it. Someone else say it right.
So I'm much more direct. I basically say, here's my card. Put it on your refrigerator because your kids are going to need it.
That's great, Jen. I got to use that one. That's great.
In essence, don't do it yourself. There's too many pitfalls, and it's just a terrible gamble.
I mean, would you fix your own car these days?
Yep. I say, would you perform surgery on yourself?
These days, I don't even think I would go to the pediatrician to do an appendectomy on an elderly person. I mean, things have gotten very specialized, and so has the law for that matter. Everybody's nodding, but nobody's jumping in and saying, yeah.
Well, let me ask this as we're coming to a close. If a person is single, they don't have children, they don't have dependents, they really don't care what happens with all their stuff. Does that person need their trust and estates done?
Well, I mean, if they don't care at all, you could say no, but they should care because they worked their whole life, or usually they spent a lot of their life working and building up something, and they should care about who it goes to. So they should have something prepared, because otherwise it could be fought after their death. No one likes people to fight after their death over their goods. It's best to just clear it up right from the get-go and just put down what they want so nobody's fighting over their goods after they die.
Not true. I think Leona Helmsley might.
You've been listening. That'll be the last word on this subject, and thank you for chiming in with Leona Helmsley. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been discussing planning for your estate. Our guests tonight have been attorneys Janet Brewer, Sherry Michaelis, Alexandru Gadzo. Our show tonight's been produced by Josh Borger and yours truly. Once again, thank you to Janet Brewer, Sherry Michaelis, and Alexandru Gadzo, and to Josh Borger. And especially our thanks to all of you for joining us tonight. And at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and stay safe.